Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, from the A Reporter at Large department of the March 7th, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Elephant in the Courtroom. A curious legal crusade to redefine personhood is raising profound questions about the interdependence of the animal and human kingdoms. By Lawrence Wright. According to the Civil Law Code of the State of New York, a writ of habeas corpus may be obtained by any, quote, person, unquote, who has been illegally detained. In Bronx County, most such claims arrive on behalf of prisoners on Rikers Island. Habeas petitions are not often heard in court, which is only one reason that the case before New York Supreme Court Justice Allison Y. Tuitt, The Non-Human Rights Project versus James Verheny et al., was extraordinary. The subject of the petition was Happy, an Asian elephant in the Bronx Zoo. American law treats all animals as things, the same category as rocks or roller skates. However, if the justice granted the habeas petition to move Happy from the zoo to a sanctuary, in the eyes of the law, she would be a person. She would have rights. Humanity seems to be edging toward a radical new accommodation with the animal kingdom. In 2013, the government of India banned the capture and confinement of dolphins and orcas because cetaceans have been proved to be sensitive and highly intelligent and, quote, should be seen as non-human persons, end quote, with their own specific rights. The governments of Hungary, Costa Rica, and Chile, among others, have issued similar restrictions. And Finland went so far as to draft a declaration of rights for cetaceans. In Argentina, a judge ruled that an orangutan at the Buenos Aires Echo Park named Sandra was a, quote, non-human person, end quote, and entitled to freedom, which in practical terms meant being sent to a sanctuary in Florida. The Chief Justice of the Islamabad High Court in Pakistan asserted that non-human animals have rights when he ordered the release of an elephant named Kavan, along with other zoo animals, to sanctuaries. He even recommended the teaching of animal welfare in schools as part of Islamic studies. In October, a U.S. court recognized a herd of hippopotamuses originally brought to Colombia by the drug lord Pablo Escobar as, quote, interested persons, end quote, in a lawsuit that would prevent their extermination. The Parliament of the United Kingdom is currently weighing a bill backed by Prime Minister Boris Johnson that would consider the effect of government action on any sentient animal. Although the immediate question before Justice Tuitt was the future of a solitary elephant, the case raised the broader question of whether animals represent the latest frontier in the expansion of rights in America, a progression marked by the end of slavery and by the adoption of woman's suffrage and gay marriage. These landmarks were the result of bitterly fought campaigns that evolved over many years. According to a Gallup poll in 2015, a third of Americans thought that animals should have the same rights as humans, compared with a quarter in 2008. But protecting animals in this way would have far-reaching consequences, among them abandoning a centuries-old paradigm of animal welfare laws. Arguments in Happy's case began in earnest on September 23, 2019, in an Oakland courtroom populated with reporters, advocates, and attorneys for the zoo. Kenneth Manning, representing the Wildlife Conservation Society, which operates the Bronx Zoo, made a brief opening argument. He pointed out that the plaintiff, the Non-Human Rights Project, or NHRP, had already bounced through the New York court system with half a dozen similar petitions on behalf of chimpanzees. All had failed. Manning read aloud from one of those decisions, which ruled that, quote, the asserted cognitive and linguistic capabilities of a chimpanzee do not translate to a chimpanzee's capacity or ability, like humans, to bear legal duties or to be held legally accountable for their actions, end quote. and that the animal therefore could not be entitled to habeas corpus. The NHRP countered that, quote, probably 10% of the human population of New York State has rights, but cannot bear responsibilities, either because they are infants, or they are children, or they are insane, or they are in comas, or whatever, end quote. Manning urged Justice Tuitt to follow precedent. Quote, the law remains well settled that an animal in New York simply does not have access to the habeas corpus relief, and that's reserved for humans. So there is nothing in this case dealing with any claim of mistreatment or malnourishment or anything with respect to Happy the elephant, end quote. Manning summarized, in short, Your Honor, Happy is happy where she is. Happy's pen at the Wild Asia exhibit in the Bronx Zoo exemplifies the aesthetic of late 20th century zoo design, creating the illusion of a natural habitat and disguising as much as possible the fact of captivity. There is a beaten path which Happy has trodden alone for the past 16 years, encircling a small pond with water lilies where she can bathe and wallow. Leafy trees surround a one-acre enclosure, which is dominated by an artificial dead tree trunk, artfully fashioned with hollows and scaling bark. The enclosure has to be cleaned constantly, as a female Asian elephant can eat up to 400 pounds of vegetation a day and excrete about 60% of that. Another elephant, Patty, lives in an adjacent pen. From November to May, when the New York weather can be cold, the animals are reportedly quartered in separate stalls scarcely twice the length of their bodies. Happy, who weighs approximately 8,500 pounds, has a high twin-domed head resembling that of an octopus and the small round ears that distinguish the Asian species from the larger African species. When I recently visited the zoo, her back was covered in dust, which elephants often use to guard against the sun and insects. Happy's heavy-lidded eyes are almost invisible in the great mass of her head. Elephants are colorblind, but see especially well at night. Her skin is gray and uniform, and has the soft, wrinkled complexity of a cerebral cortex. She and Patty will be the last elephants to inhabit the Bronx Zoo. In 2006, the institution announced that no more would be acquired. Across the country, zoos have been responding to the growing public sentiment that elephants do not belong in captivity. Although elephants are social animals, Happy and Patty don't get along, so they are separated by a cable fence, living in parallel solitary confinement. The zoo's attorney was correct, though, in stating that there had been no charges of abuse. Nothing in the vast portfolio of animal welfare laws prohibits zoos from locking an elephant who in the wild ranges many miles a day inside a pen a fifth the size of a New York City block. Most elephants in American zoos have lived in spaces half as large. Happy was born in 1971 and was kidnapped as an infant from a herd in Thailand, likely through the method of killing her mother and other female protectors. According to a database maintained by Dan Kuhl, a renowned Swedish elephant keeper, Happy was sent to a drive-through zoo in Laguna Hills, California, which had purchased her and six other baby Asian elephants, naming them for the seven dwarfs. One of them, Sleepy, died soon after arrival. The others were eventually transferred. Dopey and Bashful became circus performers. Sneezy went to the Tulsa Zoo, where he still resides. Doc, renamed Vance, broke his leg while doing a hind leg walk at a zoo in Ontario. His leg never healed, and he was euthanized. That left Happy and Grumpy, who arrived in 1977 at the Bronx Zoo, often ranked as one of the world's best. Few organizations have done as much for protecting animals and nature as the Wildlife Conservation Society, which, in addition to the Bronx Zoo, operates the Central Park Zoo, the Prospect Park Zoo, the Queens Zoo, and the New York Aquarium. The Society focuses on the conservation of six flagship groups: apes, big cats, sharks, skates and rays, whales and coastal dolphins, tortoises and freshwater turtles, and elephants. One of the Society's first projects in 1905 helped save the American bison from extinction. A campaign called 96 Elephants, named for the number of elephants thought to be killed every day by poachers, was launched in 2013. James Brahini, the director of the Bronx Zoo, stated that the Society had led the charge to help stop the ruthless slaughter of 35,000 African elephants each year for the ivory trade. As for Happy, Brahini declared with evident frustration, "We are forced to defend ourselves against a group that doesn't know us or the animal in question, who has absolutely no legal standing and is demanding to take control over the life and future of an elephant that we have known and cared for over 40 years. He went on, "They continue to waste court resources to promote their radical philosophical view of personhood." According to the NHRP, it has repeatedly offered to drop the case if the zoo consents to send Happy to one of two sanctuaries in Tennessee and in California that have indicated a readiness to accept her. Given the zoo's stated intention of eventually shutting the exhibit down, its refusal to settle the case suggests an institutional desire to put an end to the campaign for animal personhood. Officials for the Society and the Bronx Zoo refused repeated requests to comment for this article. Stephen Wise, the founder of the NHRP, grew up in Maryland, and his family went to a farmer's market once a month. There were animals for sale, in particular chickens, crammed into small cages. To Wise, they appeared to be suffering. Although he had pets, a dog named Gravy and a succession of goldfish, mostly named Jack, he had given little thought to the question of animal welfare. But the plight of the chickens so moved him that, at the age of 11, he wrote a letter to a state representative to call his attention to the subject. The representative wrote back, but nothing changed for the chickens. As a teenager, Wise joined a couple of rock bands, vaguely hoping to make a career in music. In 1968, he enrolled at the College of William and Mary. Drawn to protest against the Vietnam War and issues of social justice, he became active in left-wing politics. He thought about going to medical school, but his grades weren't good enough, and he attended law school at Boston University instead. But he was drifting. He had the profile of someone who was looking for a cause. Momentous social revolutions often begin with a book. The modern animal rights movement was born in 1975 with the publication of Peter Singer's Animal Liberation. Singer, an Australian philosopher, popularized the concept of speciesism, which he compared to racism and sexism. "All animals are equal," he asserted, adding, "The basic principle of equality does not require equal or identical treatment. It requires equal consideration." Singer did not actually advocate for legal rights, but for expanded welfare, declaring that the moral argument for equality rests exclusively on an animal's capacity for suffering and happiness, not on its intellect or its abilities. His thinking can be traced to the utilitarianism of Jeremy Bentham, the Enlightenment-era English legal philosopher and reformer. The guiding principle of utilitarianism is that society should attempt to provide the greatest happiness to the greatest number, which is typically achieved by maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain. Bentham made an enduring case for animal welfare when he wrote, "The question is not, can they reason, nor can they talk, but can they suffer?" In 1980, a friend of Wise's handed him a copy of Animal Liberation. Like many of Singer's readers, he was instantly transformed. Wise's mission in life became blazingly clear. He would defend the most brutalized and defenseless creatures, non-human animals. Over Thanksgiving weekend in 1981, Wise attended a meeting in New York of the Society for Animal Rights. The participants were interested in improving welfare laws, but Wise eventually saw limitations in this approach. The caged chickens in the farmer's market, for instance, were not covered by the Animal Welfare Act of 1966. The Maine federal law, which exempted from regulation all livestock, as well as birds, rats, and mice used in research. And even in cases where, say, pets were nominally protected by welfare laws, it is rare for abuse cases to be prosecuted. Animals were property, after all. In 1985, Wise had an epiphany. I concluded that the real problem was rights. Only entities that had rights were ever going to be able to appropriately be protected. In common law, the law generated in the courtroom by judges, not by elected legislators, rights accrue to persons, not things. So Wise settled on a strategy of seeking personhood for animals. In 1998, he unveiled the Non-Human Rights Project in an article for the Vermont Law Review titled, "Hardly a Revolution, the Eligibility of Non-Human Animals for Dignity Rights in a Liberal Democracy." The organization's goal was to get state courts to accept that a non-human animal has the capacity to possess at least one legal right, to be a person in the eyes of the law. Wise later explained to a class at Harvard Law School that he had initially tried to protect animals by taking on doggy death cases, defending canines who, after biting or mauling incidents, had been ordered to be killed. I thought to myself, I can save 5 or 6 dogs' lives a year and save some other animals, too. And that should be enough to get me into heaven. But the problem is that in the United States alone, for every beat of my heart, 160 animals are killed, that is, euthanized. In the class, he listed the animals he thought should be promoted to personhood. I argued that these non-human animals, all 4 species of the great apes, all of the elephants, all cetaceans, are so cognitively complicated that these beings should be persons today. In a 2002 book, Drawing the Line, Science and the Case for Animal Rights, he also listed dogs, African gray parrots, and honeybees. For a decade, Wise was the project's only employee, but he eventually assembled a team of volunteers that included lawyers, law students, and academics. Their first task was to determine where to make their case. His organization began scouring jurisdictions across the U.S., seeking amenable judges and charismatic animals that would make appealing plaintiffs. The NHRP decided to initiate lawsuits in New York State. It had a strong tradition of habeas corpus and the right to appeal judges' decisions, which was critical, Wise said. The point was to get into dialogue with the upper courts, where he believed judges would be more willing to overturn precedent. By 2013, Wise was in his 60s, with tousled white hair that looked as if it had been cut with garden shears and a tie that was perpetually askew. He had poured his entire career into the case of animal personhood, remaining relatively obscure despite having published several significant books, including Rattling the Cage, Toward Legal Rights for Animals in 2000, which the primatologist Jane Goodall had hailed as the animal's Magna Carta, Declaration of Independence, and Universal Declaration of Human Rights in all in one. Goodall is on the NHRP's board. Wise was finally ready to strike. Of all the animals the NHRP might have chosen to represent, it settled on chimpanzees, among the closest relatives to humans, for its first cases. Wise legal team spread across New York, searching for imprisoned chimpanzees. They found 7, 2 of them in a roadside zoo. Before the team could act, 3 of the chimps died, creating a sense of urgency. Wise dubbed the remaining animals the Chimpanzee 4. 1, living in Gloversville, northwest of Albany, was Tommy, a former performing chimp who had been in Matthew Broderick's movie called Project X. Tommy was watching cartoons on a television stationed outside his cage when Wise first saw him. Another, Kiko, was living in a private sanctuary with a few dozen monkeys in Niagara Falls. He had been rescued from an abusive career in the entertainment business. At Stony Brook University on Long Island, the Department of Anatomical Sciences had been studying the chimps Hercules and Leo to examine differences in human and chimpanzee locomotion. For 6 years, the animals were kept in a laboratory with no view of the outdoors. Chimps swing their hips much more than humans when they walk, the researchers found. The courts were unconvinced by Wise's arguments. A judge in Suffolk County summarily rejected a petition on behalf of Hercules and Leo, saying that in New York, habeas corpus applied only to persons. Of course, this was the very point that the NHRP was contesting. Although an appeals court judge, Eugene Fahey, concurred in an opinion that denied liberty to Tommy and Kiko, He also acknowledged that the litigants had raised important ethical questions. Quote, the issue whether a non-human animal has a fundamental right to liberty protected by the writ of habeas corpus is profound and far-reaching. It speaks to our relationship with all the life around us. Ultimately, we will not be able to ignore it. While it may be arguable that a chimpanzee is not a person, there is no doubt that it is not merely a thing. End quote. Having lost the chimpanzee cases in New York, Wise and his team armed themselves with dozens of friend-of-the-court briefs in support of personhood for Happy. One of them came from Lawrence Tribe, the Harvard legal scholar. It cannot pass notice that African Americans who had been enslaved famously used the common law writ of habeas corpus in New York to challenge their bondage and to proclaim their humanity, even when the law otherwise treated them as mere things. Tribe wrote, women in England were once considered the property of their husbands and had no legal recourse against abuse until the Court of King's Bench began in the 17th century to permit women and their children to utilize habeas corpus to escape abusive men. Indeed, the overdue transition from thinghood to personhood through the legal vehicle of habeas corpus must be deemed among the proudest elements of the heritage of that great writ of liberation. A precedent that Wise particularly favors is a 1772 case in England concerning James Somerset, a black man enslaved to Charles Stewart, a customs officer in Boston. When Stewart brought him to England, Somerset briefly escaped, and upon his recapture, Stewart had him imprisoned on a ship bound for Jamaica, where he was to be sold on the slave market. English supporters of Somerset filed for a writ of habeas corpus to gain his freedom. The case came before Lord Mansfield, a consequential figure in the British legal tradition. Although slavery had not been legally endorsed in Britain, an estimated 15,000 enslaved people lived there, and hundreds of thousands lived in British territories. Recognizing Somerset as a legal person would not just liberate a single individual, but set a precedent that could be financially ruinous for slaveholders. Mansfield declared, "Let justice be done, though the heavens may fall." He ruled that slavery was so odious that common law could not support it. That was the beginning of the end of slavery, first in England, then at least in the northern part of the U.S., Wise said in Tuit's court. Did they actually say the person who was enslaved was a person? The justice asked. No, they said he was free and he had rights, Rice responded. A person is an entity who has the capacity for rights. Any entity who has a right was automatically a person. Well, that's not what we are arguing here, Tuit said. We are arguing rights or duties. Lord Mansfield never inquired as to whether James Somerset could bear duties, Wise replied. It didn't matter whether he could bear duties. He was entitled to rights. He mentioned that under U.S. law, the category of personhood is so elastic that, quote, corporations are persons, ships are persons, the city of New York is a person, end quote. Not long before, he noted, a young man had been convicted of vandalizing a car dealership in Seneca Falls. On appeal, the defendant's lawyer had argued that the prosecution needed to prove a human being had been damaged by the destruction, and that Bill Cram Chevrolet was not a human being. The court ruled that the dealership was a non-human person withstanding in court. Not everyone agrees with Wise that human slavery is an appropriate precedent to invoke. When arguing on behalf of the chimpanzee Tommy, Wise cited the Somerset case, and one of the impaneled appellate judges, Karen Peters, sharply warned him off. I keep having a difficult time when you're using slavery as an analogy to this situation, she said. A very difficult time. So you might want to pursue another argument. In front of Justice Tuit, Wise also brought up a 1972 abortion case, Byrne versus New York City Health and Hospitals Corp., which he said was a spectacular case for showing that humans and persons are not synonyms. In Byrne, the question was whether a fetus was a person and had the right to life. The New York Court of Appeals ruled that a fetus may be human, but it is not also a person. Animals already have certain claims on personhood. Welfare laws give animals the right not to be abused, and courts have recognized animals as beneficiaries of trust, say when a beloved pet is included in a will. Some divorce courts have recently required judges to consider the interest of an animal that is being contested. These developments indicate a tacit understanding that animals are not mere things, even if U.S. courts have been reluctant to declare that they are persons. Wise has been canny about framing his current case around a single elephant. Not all elephants are all sentient animals. That being said, he admits that it only takes one. Manning, speaking on behalf of the zoo, warned, "As you can tell from the pleadings, this is not really about elephants. It's about elephants. It's about giraffes. It's about animals," Justice Stewart said. Elephants are the largest mammals on land. The African species can reach 10 feet in height and weigh more than 13,000 pounds. Their huge brains are capable of complex thinking, including imitation, memory, cooperative problem solving, and such emotions as altruism, compassion, grief, and empathy. Joyce Poole, an elephant biologist who has worked at Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique, told me that all this is evidence of consciousness. In an affidavit filed on behalf of Happy, she described what scientists call a theory of mind, that is, the ability to mentally represent and think about the knowledge, beliefs, and emotional states of others, whilst recognizing that these can be distinct from your own. Poole added that elephants are truly communicative, similar to the volitional use of language in humans. Elephants have a variety of calls, roars, cries, rumbles, snorts, and various trumpets, all of which can convey meaning. One of the most startling modern changes in the African elephant population is the rapid evolution of tusklessness. People told me that by the end of the Mozambican Civil War, which lasted from 1977 to 1992, 90% of the elephants in Gorongosa had been slaughtered. Only those without tusks were safe. Now, in the next generation, a third of the females are tuskless. In nature, elephants live in large matriarchal clans. Male African calves stay with their mothers for about 14 years and then merge into smaller male groups. Competition for territory has led to conflict with humans. Elephants will raid crops and knock down fences, occasionally killing livestock. In places like the palm plantations of Indonesia, farmers may poison the animals. According to the World Wildlife Fund, more than 100 people every year are killed by elephants in India alone, and the elephants are sometimes killed in revenge. Non-lethal approaches to controlling elephants may help diminish the number of fatalities, but poaching and the loss of habitat create ongoing stress. Despite the hazards, Poole rejects the common argument that elephants are safer in zoos than in the wild. "They have a better chance of living to old age in the wild," she told me. "They don't suffer the diseases of captivity, obesity, arthritis, foot ailments, behavioral abnormalities, and infanticide. Is it better for them to face poachers? I think it is." Such are the alternatives currently available to elephants. After examining videos taken of Happy in her pen, Poole observed only 5 activities or behaviors: standing and facing the fence, lifting 1 or 2 feet off the ground, perhaps to take the weight off painful, diseased feet, dusting herself, eating grass, and swinging her trunk in what appears to be stereotypic behavior, the kind of repetitive actions sometimes displayed by animals who are bored or mentally unbalanced. Only 2. Dusting and eating grass are natural, Poole testified. Alone, in a small space, there is little else for her to do. Poole appreciates the work done by the Wildlife Conservation Society, which has helped fund her studies. "They have some of the best scientists, but I don't see any of them backing up the zoo's claims," she told me. "They're not standing up saying that Happy should remain in the zoo." She compares elephants to whales and lions who need huge amounts of space to roam. "Their social lives demand it. Elephants are complex enough to weigh the challenges they face. They discuss among themselves and make collective decisions. You take all that away, and you take away what it means to be an elephant." In 1906, 7 years after the founding of the Bronx Zoo, a human being was put on display in a cage. Ota Binga, a young man from what was then the Congo Free State, was placed in the primates hall alongside an orangutan. He had been brought to the United States 2 years earlier by Samuel Phillips Verner, a missionary from South Carolina. Verner told the tale that he had discovered Binga for sale in a cage and had purchased him with a bolt of cloth and a pound of salt. What's certain is that the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair had commissioned Verner to round up a dozen pygmies for an anthropology exhibit. What happened to Ota Binga can be seen as a commentary on the evolving boundaries of personhood. Along with the African tribespeople, the fair included Inuits with sled dogs and an igloo, Ainu people from Japan, more than 1,000 Filipinos, and 2,000 Native Americans. At an exhibit called Home in the Old Plantation, black actors sang minstrel songs. It was a sprawling human zoo. Binga, whose teeth were sharpened into points, as was common among Congolese males, was presented as a cannibal. When the fair closed, Verner escorted Binga and the other tribespeople back to the Congo Free State. He claimed that when he was preparing to return to America, Binga threatened suicide if Verner wouldn't take him along. They stopped in New York, where Verner persuaded the director of the American Museum of Natural History to house Binga along with two chimpanzees while Verner spent more time in St. Louis. Binga became the museum's sole resident. He could wander through the galleries alone after closing hours, passing dioramas and taxidermied animals as if he were a character from Night at the Museum. But he became restless, and the museum grew wary of the arrangement, so Verner arranged for him to move to the zoo in the Bronx. The zoo had been founded by members of the Boone and Crockett Club, an organization of influential sportsmen, including Theodore Roosevelt, dedicated to hunting and conservation. One of the founders, Madison Grant, was a white supremacist who later wrote The Passing of the Great Race, mourning the decline of the Nordic people. Adolf Hitler occasionally quoted the book in speeches. Verner met with the zoo's director, William Temple Hornaday, and offered to loan him a chimpanzee and two reptiles, throwing Binga in as well. Hornaday was thrilled. Days later, zoo-goers found Binga in the primate house, where a sign read, "The African pygmy, Ota Binga, age 23, height 4 feet 11, weight 103 pounds, brought from Congo Free State, South Central Africa, by Dr. Samuel P. Verner, exhibited each afternoon during September." The Times covered the exhibit's opening, noting that Binga and their orangutan both grin in the same way when pleased. A delegation of black ministers went to the zoo. The Reverend James H. Gordon, the superintendent of the Howard Colored Orphan Asylum in Brooklyn, said, "Our race, we think, is depressed enough without exhibiting one of us with apes. We think we are worthy of being considered human beings with souls." Some papers condemned the shameful exhibit while also puzzling over how to classify Binga. The Indianapolis Sun determined that he was more man than beast. The Minneapolis Journal decreed he is about as near an approach to the missing link as any human species yet found. Hornaday professed to be puzzled by the outrage, explaining that Binga had one of the best rooms in the primate house. But the zoo eventually released Binga to Gordon's orphan asylum. Pamela Newkirk, in her comprehensive biography Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Ota Binga, found evidence that Verner had kidnapped Binga from his village when he was 13, meaning that he would have been 15, not 23, when he was displayed at the Bronx Zoo. Binga despaired of ever returning to Africa, and on March 20, 1916, he shot himself in the heart. 104 years later, the Wildlife Conservation Society apologized for its, quote, "role in promoting racial injustice," end quote, and acknowledged that Binga had been robbed of his humanity. Stephen Wise would like us to consider Binga's story as a parable for zoo animals. We think of them as coming from the wild, and the St. Louis World's Fair similarly presented Binga as a man untouched by civilization. But For a long time now, there has been no such thing as, quote, the wild, end quote. The Congolese people were decimated by the genocidal violence perpetuated by the brutal colonial army of King Leopold II of Belgium. In Thailand, Happy's birthplace, poaching and deforestation have reduced the once vast elephant population to endangered status. Only an estimated 7,000 remain, about half of them in captivity, giving rides to tourists or laboring in the illegal logging industry. Thailand still has an active black market for ivory, and lately there has been a flourishing trade in elephant skin used in Chinese traditional medicine. Of the two species of African elephants, forest elephants are critically endangered, and savanna elephants have declined in number by at least 60% in the past 50 years. Scientists have talked about elephant breakdown in certain communities because of chronic trauma the animals have experienced. On the other hand, herds in some parks and reserves have enjoyed modest increases in population, thanks to such groups as the Wildlife Conservation Society. Martha C. Nussbaum, a noted philosopher at the University of Chicago who also teaches at its law school, was surprised when Wise asked her to write a brief supporting Happy's case. "I had clashed with Wise," she told me. "I had said that his own particular theory of animal rights is a bad theory because it predicates rights on likeness to humans." She submitted a brief that staked out a path between welfare and rights. Nussbaum and Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, have developed a theory called the capabilities approach. In her brief, she explained that instead of animal rights being based on the capacity to engage in a social contract and to bear legal duties, the capabilities approach asks how the law can help animals like Happy not only live, but thrive. Welfare laws, Nussbaum observed, protect only a small number of animals and fail to constrain, to any meaningful extent, the widespread infliction of suffering. They ban only the intentional, purposeful suffering of some animals and fail to constrain, to any meaningful extent, the widespread infliction of suffering. They ban only the intentional, purposeful suffering of some animals and fail to recognize the impact that captivity, lack of relationships, and solitude can cause a creature like Happy. Nussbaum believes that, in order to apply the capabilities approach in a substantive way, animals must be given legal standing. "Right now, we have scraps and pieces of law that are not comprehensive," she argues, pointing to the lack of legal protection for animals raised for food. Because animals can't speak for themselves, welfare laws tend to protect them only when there is clear proof of grievous physical harm. How can animals secure protections for their capabilities? Nussbaum proposes a model based on fiduciary law. Guardians, trustees, and conservators had the legal authority to act in the interest of beneficiaries unable to take care of themselves. Nussbaum suggests that the government could designate a suitable animal welfare agency to act as a fiduciary for specific animals, which would allow them to be represented in court. "Happy should first of all be given standing," Nussbaum told me, "and then things could begin to happen." People in both the welfare and the rights camps often speak as if animals got nothing out of their relationships with humans. Before talking with Nussbaum, I was stirred by a viral video of a man playing fetch with a beluga whale off the coast of Norway. The man throws a rugby ball, and the whale streaks off to retrieve it, an apparently spontaneous game. YouTube and TikTok have repeatedly opened new windows on unexpected animal behavior. No doubt, the shift in attitudes about animal rights is in part the product of the delight that such glimpses award us. As it turns out, the story of the beluga and the rugby ball is more complicated than it initially appeared. The whale was first noticed in Norwegian waters in the spring of 2019 when he approached a fishing boat wearing a harness with a camera mount that said, "Equipment, St. Petersburg." Some people speculated that the whale was an escapee from a Russian naval base and had been trained as a spy. Norwegians began calling him Valdimir, a play on the Norwegian word for whale, Val, and the name Vladimir, as in Vladimir Putin. Russia and the U.S. have both trained marine mammals for various deep-sea tasks, But there's no evidence that Valdemir was a spy. The whale began following fishing boats into the harbor of Tufjord, charming the locals who petted and fed him. When it became apparent that Valdemir was malnourished, he was put on a feeding program, supported by the Sea World and Busch Gardens Conservation Fund. Eventually, he began foraging on his own. A new charity, the Valdemir Foundation, announced that its ultimate goal and hope was for Valdemir to be able to hunt and remain in the wild without any human interaction. But why? The story of Valdemir is, in no small part, about the longing between people and a curious animal to get to know one another, and about the transformations that can result. Why not advocate for more interaction between humans and animals when they naturally and safely occur? I asked Nussbaum if animals might have their capabilities enhanced rather than diminished by encounters with humans. The very idea that there can be friendships suggests that, she said. In a forthcoming book, Justice for Animals, Our Collective Responsibility, she argues that such relationships don't occur solely between people and their pets, or companion animals, as she refers to them. Friendships with animals in captivity pose a challenge because of the coercive nature of the relationship, and yet rich interactions do occur. In the 1970s, Irene Pepperberg, an animal behaviorist, began working with an African gray parrot named Alex. And over the next three decades, the bird acquired an astonishing mastery of English words, learning to identify objects by their color, shape, and texture, and to add sums up to six. When shown a mirror, Alex asked, "What color?" That's how he learned the word gray. He is the only non-human animal known to have asked a question. During the same period, Jan van Hoff, a scholar of chimpanzee behavior, developed a deeply affectionate relationship with a chimp named Mama. When the chimp was dying in 2016, Van Hoof was the only person who could get her to eat. A video depicting the intense emotions between Van Hoof and the chimp went viral. These relationships are friendships, Nussbaum insists, despite the fact of the animal's captivity. Making friends with animals in nature poses a greater challenge because it requires entering into the animal's world delicately and for long periods. Nussbaum cites Joyce Poole, the elephant biologist, as an example of a scientist who has established profound connections with the animals she studies. Nussbaum proposes that researchers who amass such intimate knowledge of animals create inventories of capabilities to be honored. Last May, Poole posted to her website, elephantvoices.org, a dazzling multimedia catalog of more than 300 behaviors exhibited by African savanna elephants. The archive contained some 2,400 video clips, including one in which a female adorns herself with a clump of grass as if it were a tiara. Poole began studying elephants in 1975 at a camp at the base of Mount Kilimanjaro, which had been established 3 years earlier by the researcher and conservationist Cynthia Moss. Few have done more than these two scientists to describe the complexities of elephant society, cognition, and emotion. Poole has explored the manifold ways that elephants communicate, not only through sound, but also through touch and gesture. The range of their voices is astonishing, with some sounds produced by the larynx and others through the trunk. Many sounds that are well below the range of human hearing can be detected by elephants, sometimes more than 6 miles away. Sounds at such low frequencies transmit a replica signal through the ground, which means that elephants hear through their ears, their feet, and sometimes their trunks, too, recognizing the meaning of the call as well as the identity of the caller. In 1990, Poole became the head of the elephant program at the Kenya Wildlife Service, which is based in Nairobi. 3 years later, she returned to the camp near Mount Kilimanjaro, supposing that the elephants had forgotten her. She brought along her infant daughter, Silingi. The elephants surrounded Poole's car, and when Poole held out her daughter, the matriarch suddenly emitted a loud rumble. Poole recalls the scene in her memoir, Coming of Age with Elephants. The rest of the family rushed to her side, gathering next to our window, and with their trunks outstretched, deafened us with a cacophony of rumbles, trumpets, and screams until our bodies vibrated with the sound. They pressed against one another, urinating and defecating, their faces streaming with the fresh black stain of temporal gland secretions. Poole had seen this behavior before. It was an intense greeting ceremony usually reserved only for family and bond group members who have been separated for a long time. And yet, its ultimate meaning was a mystery. As Poole puts it, who can know what goes on in the hearts and minds of elephants but the elephants themselves? In December, I visited SeaWorld San Antonio. Five orcas are kept in pools at the park where they flip, twirl, and splash in shows. Whales have much in common with elephants. They are giant mammals with long lifespans who form matrilineal pods. In the ocean, whales range over vast distances, and they can communicate at frequencies below the level of human hearing with sounds that travel for miles. They are extremely social and can express joy and curiosity. Orcas have no natural predators other than humans, and yet one population in the Pacific Northwest is critically endangered. At last count, it had only 73 residents. They are threatened by overfishing, pollution, and noise disturbance from boats that interferes with echolocation, which they use to forage. A new calf was born in 2018, thought to be the first in 3 years, but lived for less than a day. The grieving mother, surrounded by other females in her pod, carried the calf's body with her for 17 days across 1,000 miles of ocean. It would be going too far to say that the mother knew her loss was a step toward the extinction of her community, but it might also be going too far to say that she didn't. SeaWorld became famous because of an orca named Shamu, who performed aquatic tricks at the original park in San Diego. Like Happy, Shamu had been captured in the wild after her mother was killed, harpooned by whalers. Shamu bit an employee in 1971 and might have killed her if a colleague hadn't pried the whale's jaws open with a pole. SeaWorld was building up the Shamu brand, though, and one dangerous incident wasn't going to derail that. Southwest Airlines painted some of its jets in killer whale black and white. Adorable stuffed Shamu dolls were everywhere. Captive orcas in SeaWorlds around the country were given the name Shamu. Audiences invariably gasped as the whales rocketed out of the water and squealed when splashed by their tail flukes. Trainers rode on the backs of the orcas, and the whales would shoot them into the air for a swan dive. The orcas in San Antonio are as graceful as ever. But as I watched them perform, I recalled the elephant shows that used to be put on by the Ringley Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. Performances so elaborate that George Balanchine once commissioned to choreograph a pachyderm ballet. Under unrelenting pressure from animal rights organizations, the circus retired its elephants in 2016, and a year later it went out of business. SeaWorld has been similarly beleaguered since the release of a damning documentary, Blackfish, which chronicles the story of Tilikum, a performing orca who killed a trainer at the SeaWorld in Orlando in 2010. The film makes the case that the trainer's death was the inevitable result of conditions that orcas experience in captivity. There's no record of orcas killing humans in the wild. After the film aired on CNN, SeaWorld stock plummeted and there were protests outside its park. Since then, the organization has restricted interactions between trainers and whales and announced the end of its captive breeding program. Zoos and aquariums want to be seen as embassies where the human and animal kingdoms can come together, and to some extent they are. Along with sea lions and vaulting belugas, tail-walking dolphins are mainstays of the SeaWorld spectacle. Tail-walking was unknown in nature until a bottlenose dolphin named Billy was rescued from a polluted harbor in Australia in the late 1980s and sheltered for a few weeks at a water park showcasing dolphins. She apparently learned the skill by watching others do it, and after being returned to the wild, she taught it to dolphins in an estuary on Australia's southern coast. Tail walking became a fad among dolphins in the neighborhood, though it died out a couple of decades later. It was a vivid example of social learning, a prime signifier of sentience, and of the marvels that can arise from the interactions between humans and animals. The question is whether such encounters can occur without exploitation. On February 18, 2020, Stephen Wise lost his case. This court agrees that Happy is more than just a legal thing or property, Justice Stewart wrote. She is an intelligent, autonomous being who should be treated with respect and dignity and who may be entitled to liberty. Nonetheless, we are constrained by the case law to find that Happy is not a person and is not being illegally imprisoned. Tewitt stated that, in her view, the legislative process was better equipped to decide whether zoos should be allowed to keep elephants. But she noted that she found the arguments extremely persuasive for transferring Happy from her solitary, lonely, one-acre exhibit at the Bronx Zoo to an elephant sanctuary on a 2,300-acre lot. The NHRP said that it was deeply encouraged by Tewitt's sympathetic order. Wise noted that she essentially vindicated the legal arguments and factual claims about the nature of non-human animals, such as Happy, that the NHRP has been making. The group is working on an appeal. Given the court's demonstrated reluctance to grant personhood status to chimpanzees or to elephants, Happy's case will likely end where the others did, in an unambiguous rejection of setting such a far-reaching precedent. Since Wise began pursuing personhood litigation, though, judges have repeatedly expressed misgivings, acknowledging in their decisions that animals deserve more protection and consideration. They just believe that the courts are not the place to make such a momentous cultural adjustment. The sentient animals in our custody have served as sacrificial ambassadors, helping us to see the majesty of life outside the realm of human domination. Awarding certain appealing animals such as Happy the status of personhood would not remedy the cataclysm of extinction so many species face, or the vast exploitation of animals for food and labor. If Wise's campaign succeeds, it will arguably push human society toward a more equitable bargain with the animal kingdom. But the courts are rightfully concerned about the proliferation of lawsuits that might follow and the difficulty of discerning which species deserve such consideration. That has been an issue with the sentience bill under consideration in UK, which was originally aimed at protecting vertebrates and has already been expanded to include octopuses, crabs, and lobsters. In the past several decades, as the human population has doubled, the populations of animal species have declined by an average of nearly 70%. Clearly, we need to contain our heedless rapacity. There is also a danger of becoming paralyzed by the scope of the change required. We're at the beginning of a big ethical awakening, Martha Nussbaum, the philosopher, told me. It's only the beginning because people are not really prepared to make sacrifices. She advocates for vegetarianism, smaller families, and the end of the factory meat industry. How are we to recalibrate our relationship with animals that live in complex societies and have a sense of themselves as individuals? The question becomes more urgent as the future of such species grows increasingly perilous. They are penned in, harassed, and hunted, subjected to experiments, eaten, used in medicines. Zoos and aquariums have certainly been part of the human exploitation of nature, but at this stage they could also act as a reservoir for creatures that have been forced out of their natural environments because of expanding human populations and climate change. Many animals live longer and more securely in sanctuaries and nature parks overtly managed by humans than in their spoiled habitats. Focusing on the indignities of captive elephants or orcas can inadvertently divert attention from the much larger damage civilization has done to the natural world. In this important dialogue, Happy's voice is silent. No doubt, within the borders of her small pen in the Bronx Zoo, she is well cared for. And she may be exceptional in having a sense of self, which adds to the tragedy of her circumstance. Happy has become both a symbol and a pawn in the contest between advocates of animal rights and advocates of animal welfare, and in the contest between humans and animals to fulfill their capabilities. There will be conflicts which we have to arbitrate, Nussbaum told me. We think that because we found ourselves on this globe, we have a right to use it for our own sustenance. Animals have the same claim. They, too, didn't choose to be where they are. Joyce Poole observes that what elephants really need is something we can't give them. Freedom. All we can do is give them more space, she told me. The sanctuaries that would adopt Happy are an imperfect solution. Perhaps, but a fair compromise. And a sanctuary would at least allow Happy to rediscover some of her elephant's capabilities. As Poole put it, if we can't save elephants, what can we save? Time for a poem. A Song Near the End of the World by Sharon Olds from the July 12th and 19th, 2021 issue. Because I suddenly think of the bear, my head jerks up. Doesn't mean the bear is near. I was here 4 months before I saw the bear. Huge, exhausted mammal trudged by the porch. It was the bear Joe told me Sue had seen while she was picking berries. Male, 500 pounds. The bear was massive in front and tapered toward the bare patch on the furred, almost curly, truculent rear. Such a hot midsummer, such a tired bear. He was like a god, so much space was filled with bear. Like a cumulonimbus come down to earth, a density, a bear with blood in him and teeth and a bear liver and bear lights. A pirate bear, a private bear, a lone bear. It may be a father bear, it is a son bear, a quarantine bear, doing the essential work of his life, an endangered bear. We did not share breath. I was behind the window and the bear passed on the other side of the porch rails like a bear passing through bars of sunlight. And bears are imprisoned now in smaller and smaller wild jails for bears. A friend at the end of the world, it is barely known how long we can go on. A wish for the bear. Pleasure, safe cubs born and yet to be born. Ease of bear mind, bear heart's ease. And a dream of a bear heaven, hills and woods of comb-born honey. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.